That was composer and keyboardist James Raymond, who's on tour with Crosby and Nash as we speak, with a new as yet unreleased composition called Fundamentally Sound, and I kind of wish I was. Hi, most likely. I'm Spider Robinson, and you become caught in the sticky web fluid of Spider on the Web number 55, a user-suggested pod port being brought to you like all its predecessors under a Creative Commons license, no derivatives, non-commercial, be excellent to one another. Okay, for $50 billion and a half interest in a beefsteak mine, name the young lady accompanying herself on the auto harp here. I will reveal the answer later on. Please place your time-coded guesses in the safe now. All right, I will swivel some longer, louder, and livelier music on you, but first let me give you a quick recap of how I spent my summer vacation. A lot has happened since we met last, and we've got to start meeting like this, by the way, people just texting about us. For a start, many people freak out about getting older, especially when the birthday has a zero at the end. Unless there are two zeros at the end. I've always been wired up backwards, this like talk I why that's. So I may be one of the few wackos who was ever delighted to celebrate his 60th birthday more than 2 months early. Robert Heinlein taught my family and me a long time ago that everybody gets two birthdays, one when the calendar says and one when it's convenient to have the party. Hearing that Jeannie needed to be at a conference in New Jersey a few months before I was turning 60, our daughter, Terry, at once insisted on flying me out with her and organizing a combined birthday party and Robinson family reunion out there on the right-hand coast. Very ambitious person, my kid. The last Robinson reunion in the mid-50s had drawn the attention and ire of both the police of ire and the fire departments, and we'd all been required by the judge as a condition of release to swear that we would never, ever do that again. But we were lucky and got away with it this time. I became a 60s survivor in my 60s while eating my son-in-law Heron's killer Brazilian barbecue and drinking cachaça, sugarcane-based rocket fuel, with the people I love most, my wife and daughter, my father, Charles, my sister, Mary, her husband, John, who hosted the orgy, my nieces, Jeannie and Megan, their husbands or near husbands, Mike and Ken, and Tom, a first cousin I'd grown up across the backyard from and hadn't seen in nearly 40 years. He's now a dead ringer for his late father, my Uncle Al, who looked exactly like what he was, an NYPD Gold Shield, a New York homicide detective. But Tom went after an even bigger game, with equal success. He's now retired from a career hunting Russian submarines. He's as, quote, conservative as I am, quote, liberal, and we got along great. We disagreed on surprisingly little. I'd had no idea how much I missed him. Then Jeannie and I drove up to Massachusetts and did it all over again with her mom and five sisters and their families in and around New Bedford. Good times. Everybody looked great. Everybody was happy. Nobody had a sad story to tell. Before we flew home, we spent a few glorious days with Terry and Heron in New York. I hope to post some pictures at spiderrobinson.com soon of Jeannie and Terry and me at the Dakota and across the street at Strawberry Fields, singing along with a large crowd. Okay, that's as close as I get to showing vacation slides, and I think I kept it short. Let me wake you back up with a foot tapper and thigh slapper that'll have you setting out for the wig tapper, whippersnapper. This is the warlock Johnny Winter, 20 years ago in Bremen, with John Paris on bass and harmonica and Tom Compton on drums. You know him well, so what the hell? Sound the bell.
Troubles I had. If you see my woman, won't you tell her for me that you left me crying, I'm sin misery. Now I feel so sad. Nobody knows the troubles I had.
troubles I've had.
Thank you. That's Sound the Bell from Serious Business.
All right, I play you Johnny Winter for a reason, and not just because he is a demonic, if somewhat laconic, sonic tonic. He also inspired some of the very best writing I never did, but got paid for anyway. Well, let me make that perfectly confusing. Last podcast, from now on let's all just say last cast, I played you a short excerpt from Blackstone Audio's new edition of Stardance, co-written by me and Jeannie. This week, I'm going to bring you a chunk of the next novel we wrote together, Starseed. Though set in the same ficton, the same fictional universe, as Stardance, it had different characters, especially the narrator. I was taught by one of my early mentors, Alfie Bester, to open with an explosion and then build to a climax. So I had Chapter 1 open with the narrator narrowly escaping sudden death on her way to orbit for the first time. Jeannie was impatient to get to the people part of the story, to tell the readers why Morgan is on her way to orbit, why it would be particularly poignant if she were to be killed just now. Unfortunately, since Morgan doesn't die, she almost immediately reaches orbit, where a long and complex plot inexorably begins unfolding. Readers have to care about this woman, she kept saying. They have to understand why she isn't crazy to be thinking about leaving Earth behind forever. Fine, I kept saying. You figure out where to fit that into Chapter 1. It's already packed so tight it hisses. Well, one night we were sitting at a table at the Commodore in Vancouver having the same argument while we waited to hear Johnny Winter play the blues. And as Johnny came out and started to blow, Jeannie leaned over and yelled in my ear, you had to yell, "Give me a pen and paper," with such urgency that I complied automatically. I mimed, "What's up?" But she waved me off and started scribbling furiously, so I shrugged and went back to digging the man so cool they call him Winter. He rocked the joint, made the paint blister on the walls, and Jeannie was oblivious. I kept really refilling her glass of Coke from my own so she wouldn't dehydrate, and she never noticed. A little over halfway through his set, she shook herself, came back to reality, and at once was into the music, dancing in her seat. I mimed, "Well," but she waved me off. That night when we got home, she handed me what you're about to hear. All I had to do was type it. No wonder it's my favorite part of the book. Thank you, Jeannie. And thank you, Johnny. Without further ado, Ron Ron, here's me reading my wife Jean's prologue to our second novel, Starseed. Go, Jeannie, go!
Blackstone Audio presents Starseed by Spider and Jean Robinson. Read by Spider Robinson. This one's for Charlie, Dorothy, Terry Luana, and Smokey. Prologue. When Buddha transmitted our practice to Mahakashyapa, he just picked up a flower with a smile. Only Mahakashyapa understood what he meant. No one else there understood. We do not know if this is a historical event or not, but it means something. Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. I always danced. Like all babies, I was born kicking. I just never stopped. All during my childhood, it was that way. In the 1980s, Gambier Island had a permanent population of about 60, which no more than doubled in the summer. But it sure had a lot of theaters with proscenium stages. The garden, the living room, a certain clearing in the woods near Aunt Anya's place. I danced in them all, and most of all in my room with the door closed. Sometimes there was thunderous applause. Sometimes I danced for no one but myself. Sometimes for intimate friends who vanished at a knock on the door. I remember clearly the moment I first understood that dancing was what I was going to do with my life. Near sunset in late summer, 1985. Dinner and chores finished. My feet tickled. I told Dad where I was going, avoided Mom, and slipped out through the shed without banging the door. It was a kilometer and a half to the government wharf. The afternoon had been warm and wet, wet enough, I thought, to keep most of our neighbors indoors and most boats at anchor. As I came over the last crest of the road and started down to the wharf, I saw I was right. I had the place to myself. I began to run down the hill, kicking off my shoes and tossing my jacket to the side of the road. At the far end of the wharf, I slowed and carefully descended the swaying gangway to the big dock float down at water level. I turned halfway down and scanned the shoreline one more time to be sure. No one in sight. I circled around the boathouse at the foot of the gangway. The boathouse cut off sight of the land. There was nothing but me and the sea and the islands in the distance, gray-green mountains rising from the water. The water was high-lit with sparkles of color from the sun setting behind me over the forest. A warm mist came and went, invisibly. Even dry clothes are a nuisance when you dance. My clothes went under the rowboat that lay turtle-backed against the boathouse. The float's surface was rough enough for safe footing when wet, but soft enough for bare feet. I turned my back to the land and faced the sea. There are bigger theaters, but not on Earth. My parents were unreconstructed hippies, quasi-Buddhist. For their sake, I bowed to the sea, then waved to it for my own, the sober, dignified wave a serious artist gives her expectant public when she is 11 years old. A passing gull gave my cue. "Ladies and gentlemen, Rain McLeod!" The music swelled. I've become too sophisticated to remember the steps I improvised. They must have been some mutant amalgamation of what I thought ballet was and all the other kinds of dance I'd felt in my body but had no names for then. Nomenclature doesn't matter to an 11-year-old. I danced, and what was in my heart came out my limbs and torso. I've wished since that I could still dance like that, but I've lost the necessary ignorance. I do remember that I was very happy, complete. Someone in the back row coughed. Xylophus californianus, a sea lion. Distinguished from harbor seals, even at that distance, by the distinct ears. Passing Gambier on his way back home from a day of raiding. Fishermen hate sea lions. Call them pirates of the sea. They'll take one bite from each fish in your net, spoiling the whole catch, and then leave with the best one, waving it at you mockingly as they go. I always secretly liked them. They always danced, so it seemed to me. Drama and tragedy in the water, slapstick comedy when they were on land. He was perhaps 50 meters due east of the dock, treading water and staring at me. He coughed again, sounding very much like Grandfather. I didn't let him interrupt me. I worked a friendly hello wave into what I was doing and kept on dancing. I noticed him out of the corner of my eye from time to time, watching me in apparent puzzlement, but he was no more distraction than a cloud or a gull would have been until there were two of him. For a moment, I treaded water myself, planting my feet so that I faced them and dancing only with torso and arms. They were identical, gray and wet, a few meters apart, their eyes and slick heads glistening with reflected sunset. The new one gave a cough of its own, softer and higher. Grandfather and Grandmother Mead. They watched me with no discernible expression at all, giving me their complete attention, perfect bobbing Buddhas. So I danced for them. Well, at them. I made no attempt to translate what I was feeling into sea lion dance, to mimic the body language I'd seen them use so they could understand better. Even at 11, I was arrogant enough to be more interested in teaching them my dance language, telling them who I was. When you're that young, expressing yourself is better than being understood. So I continued to dance in human, and for the whole cycloramic world of sea and sunset, but began subtly aiming it at the sea lions, as though they were the two important critics in a packed theater, or my actual grandparents come to see my solo debut. What luck to have spent my childhood so far from Vancouver's ballet classes that no one had yet told me how I was supposed to move. I was still able to move the way I needed to invent anything my heart required. It felt good. That's all this highly trained 46-year-old can remember. For a time machine and video gear, you can have anything I own. The sea lions were 20 meters closer, and there were four of them now. They were treading water in ragged formation, close enough for me to see whiskers. By logical extension of my original whimsy, the new arrivals were the paternal grandparents I'd never met, the McLeods. Ghosts in the audience. It gave an added layer of meaning to what I was doing, as much awareness of mortality and eternity as an 11-year-old is capable of. I danced on. The first breezes of evening found the sweat under my hair and on my chest and chilled them. I increased my energy output to compensate. I was grinning, spinning. Seven sea lions, 20 meters away, faces absolutely blank, staring. Everything came together. Sea, sky, purple clouds of sunset, sea lions, to generate that special magic always sought and so seldom found. I lost myself. The dance began dancing me. It burst out of me like laughter or tears, without thought or effort. My legs were strong, wind infinite, ideas came, every experiment worked and suggested the next. There's a special state of being, the backwards of a trance, where you transcend yourself and become a part of everything, where you seem to stand still while the world dances around and through you. Many dancers never experience it. I'd been to that level a few times before, for fleeting moments. This time I knew I could stay as long as I wanted. Time stopped. I went on. Well, even an 11-year-old body has limits. Every dance has a natural, logical end. Eventually, with warm contentment and mild regret, I left Nirvana and returned to the world of illusion again. I was still, upright, arms upthrust toward the clouds, reaching for the unseen stars. The float was ringed by more than a dozen sea lions, the farthest within 5 meters of me. I looked round at them all, half expecting them to clap and bark like cartoon seals. They stared at me, bobbing in silent syncopation, seeming to be thinking about what they'd just seen. My first applause. I bowed deeply, and then waved grandly. Darkness was falling fast. Sweat dripped from me, my soles tingled, and many muscles announced their intention to wake up stiff tomorrow. I was perfectly happy. This, I thought, is what I'm supposed to do. My thing, as Mom was always calling it, what I would do with my life. I understood now what I had always sensed, that Mom was going to hate it, though I didn't yet understand why, but that didn't matter anymore. Maybe that's when you become an adult, when your parents' opinions no longer control. I kept silent when I returned home that night, but the next day I called grandmother in Vancouver and told her that she had won the tug of war with my mother. I moved into her huge house on the mainland and let her enroll me in ballet class and in normal school like other kids. Within weeks I had been teased so much over the name Rain MacLeod, which had never struck anyone on Gambier Island as odd, that I changed it to Morgan. It seemed to me a much more dignified name for a ballerina. It was a long time before I saw Gambier Island again. I always danced, but from the day of the sea lions, dancing was just about all I did, all I was, for 32 years, until the day came when my body simply would not do it anymore. The day in April of 2017, when Dr. Thompson and Dr. Amiga told me that even more surgery would not help, that I could never dance again. My lower back and knees were spent. I tried the dancer's classic escape hatches for a few years. Choreography. Teaching. When they didn't work for me, I tried living without dance. I even tried relationships again. Nothing worked. Including me. There were lots of trained, experienced professionals looking for work, as technological progress made more and more occupational specialties obsolete. There were few job openings for a 46-year-old who couldn't even type. Even the traditional unskilled labor jobs were increasingly being done by robots. Sure, I could go back to school and in only a few years of drudgery acquire a new profession, ideally one which would not be obsolete by the time I graduated. But what for? Nothing interested me. The salt of the earth had lost its savor. I went back to Gambier Island. By now it was becoming a suburb of Vancouver. Even in winter there were stores and cars and paved roads and burglaries. There was talk of a condominium complex. I sat for 6 months in the cabin where I had been born, waiting for some great answer to come from out of the sky. I visited my parents' graves frequently, sat zazen in the woods, split cords of wood, read the first 20 pages of a dozen books, walked the parts of the island that were still wild by day and night. Nature accepted my presence amiably enough, but offered no answers. Nothing. I went down to the wharf and consulted the sea lions, as I had many times. They had nothing to say. They just looked at me, as if waiting for me to begin dancing. After enough days of that, nothing started to look good to me. I filled out the euthanasia application I had brought with me, putting down earliest possible for date and leaving the space for reason blank. I'd have a response within a week or two. By the end of the month, unless I changed my mind, my problems would be over. In my bones, I was a dancer, and I couldn't dance anymore. Not anywhere on earth. That very night, I was lying in the hammock behind the house watching the stars when my eye was caught by a large, bright one. It moved relative to the other stars, so it was a satellite. It moved roughly north to south and was quite large. It had to be top step. Funny, I'd never thought of it before. The house the star dance built, as the media called it. Transplanted asteroid, parting gift of alien gods, the place where they made angels out of people. Hollow stone cigar, phallic womb in high orbit. Gateway to immortality, to the stars, to freedom from every kind of human fear or need there was. And all it cost was everything you had, forever. Dancers say, you go where the work is. Suddenly, at age 46, I had nowhere to go but up.
All right, thank you, Spider. That was not bad. I probably couldn't have done much better myself. Now, as a admittedly funky but still spunky recovering folk music junkie, I am frequently asked by people with nothing better to do with their time, where the hell did all the protest singers go? What happened to all the damn protest songs? You guys with the guitars used to be pissed off all the time, and Neil Young would sit down and whip off Ohio in like 30 minutes flat in a white heat of rage, and the next thing you know, people were singing it in the streets, and where's the protest singers today when we could really use them, when there's a really hellacious war going on? And I got tired of being asked that same question, and so did Neil Young. Neil Young has been asked the question as many times as anyone alive, and he got sick of it and finally started saying the truth. He started saying, there are just as many protest songs being written today as there ever were. You just ain't hearing about them, because they ain't getting played on no radio, and they ain't getting recorded by no record company, and they ain't getting distribution from nobody, and how the hell would you know? And people say, yeah, right, Neil, sure. They're all out there protesting the war. We just can't quite hear them, right? Yeah, he said, I'll show you. And on his website, he put up a notice saying, you got any protest songs? Swivel them on me. I'm ready. He collected, I forget how many, 1,000 protest songs, posted them all on the site. And one of the best and most successful of them was provided by an old shipmate of mine, Gail Mead. Gail and Jeannie and me and a bunch of like-minded souls, including three doctors, Amy Baxter, Louis Calderon, and Charles Daniels, found ourselves fellow passengers once on the SS Zuiderdam from Vancouver up the Inside Passage to Alaska. And as we entered that state, we all felt ourselves pale, and I'm sorry to say. Sorry, it's an ungovernable vice. Even in remarkable company, Gail stood out. She looked good, she sang good, she played guitar good, and she wrote amazing songs full of heart, smarts, and social conscience. I played you the title track of her first CD, Letters Home, several casts ago. And she's just come out with an even better one with a title right out of the 60s. CD's called Common Good. I'm powerfully tempted to play you the title track, because in addition to lyrics that thrill me and some sweet harmonies, it features some typically ear-popping lead guitar by my mainest man, Amos Garrett. Amos is almost invisible in this particular track I'm going to spin for you, even though he's all over the album. But America and Canada, and for that matter Iraq, needs to hear these particular lyrics so badly just now, I hope you'll consider playing this on speakers in public places a lot.
I read about conspiracies and something called democracy, global warming, dirty bombs, and prophecies of doom. I've had it up to here with the country ruled by fear. Is this the best America can do? I refuse to live in Armageddon's shadow anymore. Let's not let one. When patriots are pilloried for standing up to hate and greed, it's time to make a change. I refuse to live in Armageddon's shadow anymore. Let's not let one more mother's child die in another war. I refuse to be terrorized, focused, grouped, and crucified. I refuse to live a lie. Another world is possible. We can make it, you and I. We can make it, you and I. To satisfy the predatory gleam in a rich man's eye. I refuse to live in Armageddon's shadow anymore.
can make it, you and I.
Sing it, cousin. Because you know what the media are today? TV, radio, newspapers, magazines, most of the news websites. They're not newsmen or women. They're not journalists. They aren't entertainers. They're not even pimps. They're fucking drug dealers. They push fear. They work for the ones who like us scared. Our fault as much as theirs. We pay them for the drug. Let's stop. Or if we just can't, let's at least be afraid of some of the right things. Let me read you an excerpt from one of the most riveting autobiographies I've read by the goddess of the unreconstructed folkies and one of the rare survivors of the dreaded iconic plague, Janice Ian. But before I give you a short chunk of Society's Child, her new book, I'll let you tell her a little about it. From the new double CD, The Autobiography Collection, here's Janice Ian and My Autobiography.
I know you and I'll agree, what this world needs is a lot more me. Well, I have got the remedy, gonna write my autobiography. Led a fascinating life, had a husband and a wife, but you will truly be amazed just how humble I have stayed. Enough about me, let's talk about you. What do you think of me? You must feel such gratitude that you will get to read my autobiography. My life doesn't have a very good plot, guess I'll have to lie a lot. Should be easy to make things up, there's no one left to call my bluff. A lot of my orphans have passed on, rested drugs and the memory's gone. So I'll write my own history in my autobiography. I say I slept with a Kennedy, I don't remember which one. They all looked the same to me, or they did when we got done. Maybe they'll film it for TV, wonder who they'll cast as me. Should be somebody I look like, Sigourney Weaver, it'd be alright. Gonna be hard to deal with fame once the whole world knows my name. But I'll stay humble and grateful to all the little people like you. 1,000 pages more of me and all I've seen and done. It will be my legacy, and that's just volume one of my autobiography.
It wasn't just the weirdness of being 16 and having a huge hit record, or being close friends with people like Janis Joplin and Jimi Hendrix. You also have to factor in the general weirdness of the times. As Janis says early on in Society's Child, being followed by the government, too, seemed normal. All the performers I knew were being followed. You could never tell how many people at a party or backstage were actually informers. We used to joke that organizations like the National Student Association could never have existed without CIA funding. We joked, but we didn't really understand just how serious it was until 1976, when a Senate Intelligence Committee started investigating the CIA's involvement in domestic affairs. The CIA had started something called Operation Chaos in 1967 to wage a clandestine war against the youth and civil rights movements. Who knew? I was staggered to read a description from the Chaos files of their goals in targeting war protesters, civil rights activists, and other public figures. Show them as scurrilous and depraved. Call attention to their habits and living conditions. Explore every possible embarrassment. Send in women and sex. Break up marriages. Have members arrested on marijuana charges. Investigate personal conflicts or animosities between them. Send articles to the newspapers showing their depravity. Use narcotics and free sex to entrap. Use misinformation to confuse and disrupt. Get records of their bank accounts. Obtain specimens of handwriting. Provoke target groups into rivalries that may result in death. Scary stuff. For us, it was impossible to separate protesting against the war from the civil rights movement, using drugs, and living on music. The rest of the country had managed to ignore most of it until San Francisco's Summer of Love got national attention from the press, and large portions of America that still yearned for the simplicity and rigidity of the 50s had their minds blown. People were afraid their children would be infected, would drop out of the mainstream and into the counterculture, advocating free love and free sex and turning into drug-ridden lunatics dancing on the streets of Haight-Ashbury. A backlash was beginning. All right, now I'm going to jump ahead several pages and read you another excerpt which gives you an idea of just how scary it got. On April 4th, I went down to the village to see B.B. King. He wasn't an icon yet. He was still playing some dive clubs. Jimmy had introduced me to his music, and we made it a point to go see him together whenever possible. I loved that B.B. had named his guitar Lucille. When he played it, he treated it like I imagined he'd treat a woman, gently, but with a lot of strength behind it. B.B. was opening at the Generation Club for Big Brother and the Holding Company, so it was old home week before the show. Jimmy finished his own gig early and came to watch B.B.'s set with me. He was pretty pleased because he'd bought the club just a little while earlier, intending to turn it into a studio. The two of us stood at the back of the room, slouched against a wall. The place was only half full, but somehow B.B.'s music always sounded better if he stood up. At some point during the show, a man walked on stage and handed B.B. a note. B.B. read it, looked down at the floor for a while, then announced that Martin Luther King Jr. was now officially declared dead. We stood in silence against the wall, watching as B.B. clutched Lucille in his arms. Time stopped. We'd been through Kennedy's assassination a scant 5 years before. That had been shocking enough. But Dr. King? Who would want to assassinate the most famous pacifist on Earth? B.B. began to play, rocking Lucille back and forth as he clutched her to his chest, and the guitar moaned as tears streamed down his face. Tears streamed down all our faces. With Kennedy, we had lost a president. With King, we'd lost a future. I stayed at the club with Jimmy until early morning, then made my way to Midtown for a meeting. It was funny the way the world continued about its daily business in the face of such tragedy. People seemed a little more solemn than usual, but the good weather had finally arrived, and every so often I'd catch someone smiling or nodding as they scurried along. Around 10 that morning, business finished, I decided to walk home. I strolled casually up 6th Avenue, checking out the store windows, taking my time. It was surprising how unfazed Manhattan was. In New York, no matter how bad things get, a few hours of great weather and everyone's happy again. Even the suits looked relaxed as they hustled to their day jobs. High heels made clicking sounds against the pavement, beating out a staccato rhythm that jangled in my ears. We were miles away from the riots beginning to fester all over the country. There were a couple of bongo players on the corner of 52nd Street, so I stopped to put a dollar in the hat. A block later, I stepped under a hotel awning and collided heavily with a large, florid man who knocked me to the ground. I remember thinking as he approached that he was dressed too warmly for the weather. His tie was unknotted, and his face was red from the heat. I expected him to move out of the way, but he made a beeline for me, and we crashed. I thudded to the sidewalk and lay there for a minute, dazed, as he hurried off. When I opened my eyes, I could see pedestrians carefully stepping around me. I'd landed so hard that I couldn't catch my breath. The mass of humanity just rolled right by, no one pausing to give me a second glance. They probably think I'm stoned, I thought. I pulled myself up to a sitting position just as a thin man in a lightweight suit stopped and put out his hand. He helped me over to a corner of the hotel entryway, and I sat down again, propped against a wall. He reassured me, saying something like, "You're fine, kid. You just had the wind knocked out of you. Nothing broken." I thanked him for the help, and he handed me an open bottle of Coke, saying, "Here, take this. I just opened it. Haven't even had a sip. It'll raise your blood sugar, get you back to normal in no time." And with that, he walked away. I sat for a few more minutes, nursing my bruised butt against the hard pavement and sipping on the Coke. It was way too sweet, so after a while I rose and threw most of it away. I started back uptown, still feeling a little wobbly, but grateful I hadn't broken anything. A block or two later, I started feeling even shakier. For some reason, I wasn't seeing well. The air was shimmering. I could see dust motes floating down from the sky above. Then the streetlights came on, one after another, like dominoes, which didn't make any sense because it was still daytime. But I could see them glowing, could feel the heat from them hitting the top of my head. I stopped and leaned against the wall, staring at the road. The asphalt looked like it was starting to bubble. I raised my eyes to look across the street. I could just make out the revolving door of an office building. The windows above it were glaring at me, gaping and malevolent. I'd been dosed. If I'd drunk the entire bottle, I might never have come back. I looked down at the ground again, trying to get oriented. There were cracks in the sidewalk, and they were starting to catch fire. Little flames danced around me, sucking at my pants legs, but I felt no heat from them. A car began sinking into the road as molten lava bubbled and burst all around it. A nearby fire hydrant exploded into flames. Buildings were melting all around me. People's faces were liquefying, running like open sores into the street. It was horrendous. I pressed back against the wall, trying to fall through it and escape to some other place. It was hard to think. It was hard to not think. I wondered why I couldn't hear people screaming as they and their cars got sucked into the abyss. My shoulders pressed against the bricks. My eyelids were propped open. The whole world was drenched in blood. It was pouring from my eyes. It was pouring from my ears. It was gushing from my pores until I couldn't see for the metallic red surrounding me. It went on forever. Then, abruptly, the scene shifted. The fires went out and the blood seeped into the gutters. The cars became cartoon figures running up the avenue on little centipede legs. They busily exchanged information with the feelers coming out of their headlights. They chittered in loud, high voices, while the voices of people around me slowed down, deepened, sped up like a tape recorder at a Mach. I heard someone laughing and realized it was me. I looked down at my arms and saw that my hands were on fire. I watched in astonishment as the flesh melted away and only charred bones remained. Through it all, I kept thinking, I have to get to Carol's. I have to get to Carol's. She'll know what to do. So I started walking in a direction I hoped was uptown. I stopped at every corner, not sure whether the light was actually red or green, and didn't step off the curb until the people around me began moving. A few times I sat down on a bench or sill and closed my eyes, but that made it even worse. At one point a policeman stopped me and asked if I was all right. I looked at him uncertainly, unable to tell whether he was real or not. Then I turned and kept walking. With each step I took, time slowed and expanded until I felt like I was wading in water over my head. I had no idea how I continued to breathe. It was a miracle. By the time I arrived at Carol's apartment, I was completely incoherent. It should have taken an hour or two to walk there, but I arrived after dark. I couldn't tell her what was going on. I just stood at the door, eyes unfocused, until she took me by the hand and pulled me into the kitchen. She made me a cup of egg drop soup, and I sat on a mattress and sipped at it, telling myself it was just eggs swimming around in the cup, not wriggling worms. I finally went to sleep and fell into a nightmare that found me alternately dozing and screaming, yelling things that made no sense, and trying to break out of my body. To where, I don't know. Peter came down from Wesleyan, and someone must have called my dad, because I remember him trying to get into the room. Peter barred the door with his body, yelling, "This is all your fault!" everyone thought I'd finally cracked under the stress of my career, the divorce, the tapes being taken. After 3 or 4 days, I calmed down enough to speak a little, and Carol told me Dad insisted I'd be taken to a psychiatrist he'd found. She'd wanted to take me to a therapist she knew in Philadelphia, but my father said I was a minor, and no matter what anyone wanted, he was still my legal guardian. If she took me out of state before I was cleared by the psychiatrist, there'd be hell to pay. She made the appointment. I was still hallucinating on and off, so Carol took my arm as we walked into his office, making sure I sat on the chair and not the empty air. I remember thinking to myself that this was all nonsense. I disliked him on sight. He was an ugly little man seated behind an absurdly big desk, diplomas hanging everywhere on the wall behind. I stared at his bald head while Carol described what had happened as best she could, and I wondered whether he had a wife who loved him. Unlikely, I decided. He was much too awful-looking. When Carol finished, he put down his pen and asked me what I saw. Still staring, I said, "A turnip. You look like a turnip." Which was pretty accurate, but also weird enough to convince him to put me on something called Stelazine. I didn't realize it then, but Stelazine was the drug of choice for bringing someone down from a bad acid trip. I took it, and voila! Just like that, in a few hours, I was my old self again. Except I wasn't. Not just emotionally, but physically. The doctor had forgotten to tell us that the drug's effects were cumulative and would quickly cause something called tardive dyskinesia. I took the Stelazine for about a week while I remained with Carol, who made sure I took the pills as prescribed throughout the day. By the time we left town for Philly, the drug was having its secondary effects. My tongue was thick. I was drooling. I couldn't keep my head from lolling around. I must have looked like a complete idiot when we walked into the shrink's office. He took one look, pulled out some serum, and gave me a shot. 5 minutes later, all the symptoms went away. He asked what had happened, but I couldn't really tell him. Between the Stelazine and my psyche's desperate attempts to protect me, the entire scenario had become sketchy. I knew I'd been dosed, but I also knew that in my business, plenty of gossips would prefer to think I'd just lost my mind. Too much too soon and all that. No one would hire me if I seemed unstable, so I kept silent and told everyone I was fine, just fine. The doctor told me he'd like to do a follow-up, so I arranged to return and take a battery of psychological tests from his partner. My father was horrified. People like us didn't seek psychological help. People like us got through whatever the cost. We toughed it out. Hadn't he just done that with my mom? What was wrong with me that I needed to talk to a stranger about my problems? Once they found out I was over my mysterious illness, the world descended again. The record company needed an album cover to make the release date. The agency needed to serve decisions about touring to publicize the album. Gene needed to make sure I was ready to go back to work. Dad suddenly decided to get involved in my life, and he thought if I was crazy enough to seek professional care, I should probably be institutionalized for a while. He began making noises about doing just that. Carol, sticking to my side like a shadow, took one look at the lunacy going on around me and thought, "These people are crazy. I've got to get her out of here." So she booked 2 flights to Bermuda and made a reservation at a shabby cottage with 2 tiny bedrooms behind someone's main house. The night before departure, Carol and I went back to the Generation Club. Jimmy had started construction, and cables and studio equipment were everywhere. There were enough instruments to open a shop, including a nice Hammond B3. I made myself at home in front of it while Carol grabbed bass guitar. We sat around what would become Electric Ladyland and jammed for hours. At the end, Jimmy invited Carol back to his place, and in one of the biggest sacrifices of her life, she said no, we had a plane to catch. All right, that's a reasonably representative sample of Society's Child from Tarcher Penguin, a remarkable story of a remarkable person who lived a remarkable life in truly remarkable times. Jeannie and I had the warm pleasure of seeing her live in concert a couple of nights ago at Capilano College here in Vancouver, and she just blew us away. She held a room packed full of people spellbound for 3 hours with just her and a guitar. Maybe you'll get lucky and she'll pass through your town. Check JaniceIan.com. Here's another bonus track from the double CD, the Autobiography Collection. This is Janice's original working tape of the first song she ever wrote. Here's Janice Ian at age 12 with hair of spun gold.
was just the age of five. My world had just come alive. Wondrous things to be seen and be done. All that I could think of was fun. With hair of spun gold, lips of ruby red, and eyes as deep as the deepest sea. And when I was just the age of 10, my life it did change again. I threw away all my childish toys and worked on getting noticed by the boys. And when I was just 13 years of age, going steady was all the rage. Mama picked me out the cutest little boy, my little leather jacketed toy. And tear of spun gold turned to black as the night. Lips of ruby red were turned to pale pink. But now when I was 15 years of age, he had my hand in marriage. And when 15 years of age, in my arms I held my babe. And now I'm 21, you know I feel my life's over and done. And I'm looking down on my little child, wondering if she'll be so wild. She's got hair of spun gold, lips of ruby red, and eyes as deep as the deepest sea. And I'm looking down on my child, I swear she'll have the time. There'll be time to love, there'll be time to learn. For childish memories she won't yearn. Time to laugh, we'll find time to play. She won't have to throw her toys away. I swear to you, we'll wait for time to take its time.
Well, according to the digital display on the, well, pretty much everything in the room, it's time to go. I know I promised you some more of me reading from the works of my friend John Varley, and I'll get to that next time, I'll swear. But to make up for it, I have an announcement I hope you'll like. From now on, I intend to try and post a second podcast each month, ideally on the third Friday, and these will consist almost entirely of music, a solid hour of it with as little talk as possible. I've got so much terrific, eclectic new music backed up to lay on you that I just can't get it done in one podcast a month or even two of the usual ones. So if you come back in 2 weeks, you should find a full bucket of some of the most amazing music you've never heard yet. I hope you can dig it. I thank you all profusely for your generous contributions and especially your subscriptions. The rest of you deadbeats, visit SpiderRobinson.com and cough up already, for Christ's sake. I look like a mortgage banker to you? By the way, Jeannie usually reads the prologue of Starseed when we go to science fiction conventions. She read it at the National Mall in Washington, D.C. at the 2006 National Book Festival. If you were wondering why she didn't just read it for you in this cast instead of me, she planned to, but she's just too damn busy trying to get Stardance translated into a movie. To track the progress of her and her partner James Spasto, visit StardanceMovie.com. Oh yeah, I nearly forgot, the singer auto-harpist who opened this cast. Did you guess her identity? You never suspected there was a thread of logic running through this whole thing, did you? The singer was raised in the same general area as Johnny Winter. And so was John Varley, actually. And she was a very good friend of Janice Ian, and she even has the same first name, and that was the earliest known recording of Janis Joplin. Please come back in a couple of weeks for the first All Music Spider on the Web, number 56, and on the first Friday of November for the usual nonsense. Till then, try and spread giggles.
I don't like messing about people's names. There's a chap called Patrick Troughton, the old good Trouty Trouty Ho. He was a great pantomime. And in that police box, talk on the dormant entry mode, and then suddenly, well, where the visual does an evanescent thrucker's fadeo and ups up the nearest planet talkers.